Thank you, Father Willard. My name is Jack Red, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. Save your Confederate money. The South will rise again. I see the Kentucky Colonel over there. The other night when we had that opening meeting, there was a Lieutenant Stevens here. Police Department. And I want to report that he's a very religious man. I met him later walking through the back. And he was praying. He was saying, "Oh, Lord, please don't let them get drunk." And I wondered just what the hell they would do if we all got drunk at the same time. It's always customary to start with a little story so that you don't think that I'm a real square. I'll tell you a little story about Mary in Ireland. She went up to the priest one night and she said, "Father, he's drunk again." And the priest said, "Oh my God, no." And she said, "Yes, it's true, he's drunk again." And he said, "Mary, I don't know what we're going to do." He said, "Every time we get this lad sober, we've tried every which way. We've tried to love him and feed him and coax him and beg him." He said, "I don't know what else to do." Then suddenly he had an idea. He said, "You know, Mary," he said, "that house that you live in is at the bottom of a little lane and there are bushes on both sides." He said, "Why don't we try and scare him sober?" He said, "Tonight when he comes home, why don't you be in the bushes? And you have a big sheet over your head. And you jump out in front of him and scare him. Wave your arms about and tell him you're the devil. Maybe that'll do it." So here's this poor soul. She didn't belong to Al-Anon, of course. She's out there in the bushes at midnight. She's got a big white sheet over her. And she's waiting for himself to come home. And here he comes down the lane, and he's hitting both sides, and he's singing. And she waits till he's about 10 or 15 feet in front of him, and she jumps out, and she waves her arm. She says, "I'm the devil, I'm the devil." And he says, "Oh, let me shake your hand, I married your sister." Now, the other day, they stuffed me in a plane in LaGuardia Airport. Man, I hate them damn things. Flying is for the birds. And the only reason that I fly is they have an Alcoholics Anonymous airline, AA, on everything. If it doesn't go American, I don't go, period. But I know when I'm sitting there and I see AA on the spoons and the knives and the forks and the cups, I say, "I'm all right." You see, I'm very out of place at these functions. I don't feel good at all. I'm a very quiet individual. I like to sit home with my dog. He thinks he's a cat. He got hit with a car. You ever see that big slob climbing into my lap, you'd scream. But you see, I have had much of this previously, being away from home. And I have a little home now, and I like to be in it. But it's different. Because when I have a call to go to an AA meeting, I go. I don't care where it is. And it's quite difficult. Because when I get on a plane, I have to hold my breath. And this is a long way back to LaGuardia. It's a damn fine thing that they stopped at Chicago and Phoenix. I never would have made it out here. But you see, I am a grateful alcoholic. And I come to these meetings because my friend upstairs tells me to come. And I come because I'm alive. And I've been giving back my life, and I've been giving back so much in this world that I must come. So I stand here today and tell you that I'm Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic. And it doesn't make a little bit of difference what my name is. The fact is that I'm an alcoholic and I'm here because I suffer from a very serious, fatal disease. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. Very misunderstood and very effective. And yet, on the outside, so many, many millions of alcoholics who still don't know that this is the proper way to live. I brought down some pieces of paper here, reprinted from a Philadelphia newspaper. It's not supposed to be reprinted, of course. But so far, I've reprinted 450,000 of them. Because I'm convinced from my own experience and from the experience of many other people coming into AA that the most important thing in the alcoholic's life is to know that he suffers from a disease. Because the alcoholic is an individual who roams through the world with 2 feet firmly planted in midair. And at the hell of a situation. And he hears on one side that he's a moral degenerate. And he hears on the other side that he's a very weak-willed person. And he hears from his wife that he's a very unloving husband. And his children hate him. So he's a very confused individual. And there's nothing much going on the outside that will relieve him of his confusion. It's not until he comes here to Alcoholics Anonymous that they tell him that he suffers from a disease and that he's a sick person. So it's my hope and my prayer that there will be one individual here today who will benefit by something that I say. And I know that there will be one because my friend upstairs wouldn't send me here if there were not someone here that needed me. So that one individual, you best listen good, because I hate flying. Now, this little piece here is by Dr. Lester J. Coleman. And it says, speaking of your health, the disease of alcoholism. And it goes on to say that alcoholism is an actual physical illness, sometimes described as an allergy because it reflects a lack of tolerance to alcohol. It is not a mental illness. And the word not is in italics for emphasis. It is not a mental illness. Bouts of excessive drinking commonly produce personality changes in the alcoholic, which are too often mistaken as mental illness. And these temporary changes in personality are due to the chemical effect of alcohol and disappear when the alcoholic returns to sobriety. It goes on to say that the alcoholic differs from other drinkers not by the amount of alcohol he drinks, but by his body's chemical reaction to it. And it goes on to say the only effective treatment for alcoholism is total and permanent abstinence. And it also further goes on to say that the way that the alcoholic can achieve total and permanent abstinence is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because these people are the individuals who have learned to live with their disease. And that they are very willing to teach this individual how that he can live with his. And they help people gain emotional strength and dignity as human beings. So that today is why I am here. To help one individual out there regain emotional strength and dignity as a human being, and for no other reason. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has meant my life to me. Everything in this world that I have, own, or hope to have, or be, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. I take no pills. The only time that I see a doctor is when one of them is alcoholic and looks me up. And then I do my best to help him. And if he can get a little stupid, he can understand me and save his life. So this is the place. And I'm so emphatic about Alcoholics Anonymous because when I came to AA, I had to be sure that I was in the right place. I had seen so much in my day that I was not convinced that AA was for me. And I say that in all sincerity. Because I went out about it among my friends after I was sober for a little while. And I told them that I was sick. And they said, yeah, we know. In the head. And I went home to my brothers and sisters. And I said, I'm sick. I have a disease. And they said, yeah, I know, in the head. Well, now, if I have a mental illness, I don't belong here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't belong here. And it was terribly important for me to belong somewhere. I had no place else to go. So when I came to AA, I had to know that I was in the right place. And if you're you, and you're sitting there, and you're wondering whether or not you're in the right place, I guarantee you that you are. And I stand here before you and tell you that I am a miracle. Without fear of contradiction, I am a living, walking, talking miracle. And everything that I have, everything that I am, I repeat again, I owe to AA. I didn't understand what Dave meant the other night when he talked about tablets. The only tablet I ever knew was what I bought for my children at school to write in. This is a very important part of the message that I have. AA is a whole and complete answer for the alcoholic. Because some 36 or 8 odd years ago, a miracle happened in this world. Canada calls it the greatest phenomenon of the 20th century. Because a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic, doomed to death in those days, as a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic, was given a gift. He was unemployable. He had no one in this world to turn to. And out of the depths of despair, he cried out for some help. And he said, if there be a God, let him show himself now. And not tomorrow, not next week, now. Now is when I need you. If you dare, speak up. And the higher power did speak up that day to Bill Wilson. And he gave him Alcoholics Anonymous. He told him to go down below and look in the bed at the wreck they had brought in the previous night. And that if he would go down there and take care of this individual, not leave that particular day, that when that individual got well as he was, then the two of them would leave together and keep each other sober. Not keep themselves sober, but keep each other sober. And this was a humble beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous because they left there that week later together, helping each other. Unable to help themselves, but able to help the other individual, and by helping the other individual, return the help to them, and they maintain their own sobriety. I'm here today because of what happened 38 years ago to a very pitiful, helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic. He had his spiritual experience, and he was given a gift from a higher power to help all alcoholics that are suffering from the disease that we suffer from. And I was born just like everybody else. I had a mother and I had a father. And I don't know about what you've heard about, but I knew both of them quite well. They were both nice people, and I think for about 6 months they enjoyed me. But about age 6 months, things became rapidly different with me. Because, you see, I suffer from a very real disease. And it manifested itself in me, not the disease of alcoholism, but the predisposition toward it. When I was old enough to remember back, I was born an alcoholic. But as you will hear, that you can't be an alcoholic unless you take alcohol into the system. So I was born with all the manifestations of the disease of alcoholism. And I would like to talk just a little bit about the disease of alcoholism. As a good doctor here tells us, a very real physical disease, chemical in nature. It bankrupts in 3 departments in our lives. The one chemical, physical disease that we suffer from robs us of our spiritual life. It robs us of our physical health. And it enables us to do things that normally the alcoholic would not be able to do. So then we have the one physical disease manifesting itself in 3 areas, mental, physical, and spiritual. I don't have to tell you about the physical disease of alcoholism. You see the watery eyes, the shaking hands, the puking, the retching, physical manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. I don't have to tell you either about the mental manifestation of the disease that we suffer from. Wherein an individual will be able to take a paycheck and money that belongs home and shoes on his kid's feet, and spend it over a bar, not even know that he did it. It enables us to do things that we don't ever think we are capable of doing. And then when we come to the spiritual manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. Spirituality to me is simply, a spiritual person is simply an individual
who is wanted and needed and loved in this world. Have nothing whatsoever to do with religion. A spiritual person is wanted and needed and loved. And you can see how very readily the alcoholic becomes unwanted, unneeded, and unloved. So there we have the one disease affecting us in three areas of our lives. And this happened to me at a very early age. I was an alcoholic when I was born. But it took a drink to put the word alcoholism into my life. The doctors tell us now that the predisposition toward alcoholism can be found in children. Well, I was one of those children. Because I was born with ungrounded and unfounded fear. I never knew what was going to happen, and I was terrified of everything that did. I lived in fear. When it was time for me to go to school, I couldn't. I could go to school, and I would throw up my breakfast on the way. Because I was afraid, and I couldn't tell you what I was afraid of. And when I spoke to my mother about my fears, my mother, God rest her, would say, Jack, be like your brother. You'll be all right. And I tried to be like my brother for many years. My brother was a kind of a kid that always hung his pants up. He went to church when it wasn't even Sunday. And when he died, he was 37 years on one job. My average was about 37 jobs a year. So for me to be like my brother was a terrible, horrible failure for me. And I tried to be like the kid up the street. I couldn't be that either. I couldn't be anybody. I was a round block in a square hole. And it, time went on, and I got a little older, a little larger, a little bigger. My fears developed even more. Now, my father was an alcoholic. And when he came home drunk, I was terrified. I was terrified. I was absolutely stark, raving terrified. And I was one of nine children, and all the other kids felt as I did. And I often wonder how they could sleep with my father drunk. My father wasn't a terribly bad man. He was an alcoholic. He drank, made a lot of noise. He broke up the house once in a while. He would threaten my mother, but he was just a plain old run-of-the-mill alcoholic. He worked hard when he worked, and he'd get drunk. He'd take two drinks. He'd tell the boss what to do with the job. He was quite a normal alcoholic, and I hated him. You see, in the beginning, I tried to convince my father that if he would stop drinking, everything would be all right. He would promise me he would. So he would stop drinking for a little while. Then he would come home drunk, and he would shatter me again. I'm one of nine children, and I was the only one. And I couldn't understand. How could everybody be so quiet and peaceful and eat and go to school, get good marks, when my mother was living in terror? And my mother had no money to pay the rent. And there was very little on the table to eat. And I never had a new pair of shoes. And when I went to school, I didn't have a dime for a notebook. And I was so terribly ashamed. And I don't know what I was ashamed of. I wasn't drinking. My father was. But I was ashamed nevertheless. I thought that everybody on the block and everybody in the school knew the kind of degradation that we lived when my father drank. And it distorted me terribly. It distorted me to such an extent that when I was age 12, I couldn't sit in the kitchen with my, in the living room or the dining room with my family. I had learned to hate each and every one of them because they were so different from me and I couldn't be like them. And I couldn't talk to nobody about the fear I had because they would laugh at me. And I couldn't tell them what a horror it was for me to go to school and sit there and be asked stupid questions. And even if I knew the answer, I couldn't answer. Because if I answered, someone might laugh at me, and I was terribly ashamed to be laughed at. So I was a kid that didn't belong anywhere in this world. And then at the age 12, something happened. I was put into a bedroom with my kid brother. My brother was 10 and I was 12. And he came up from under the bed with a bottle, and he said, Jack, look what I found. And he said, what is it? He said, I don't know. It looks like what the old man drinks. And it was a bottle of wine. And it was just a kid's trick. Because, you see, at this time, I knew that my father and alcohol didn't mix. I knew that my father drank trouble. I didn't care whether he drank beer, wine, or whiskey. I knew immediately when he picked up a drink, there was going to be 3 or 4 or 5 days of terror in the home. Terror for me and my mother. The rest didn't bother too much. But you see, I looked at that bottle and it never occurred to me that I could be like my father because I never wanted to be like him. I thought he was a weak-willed person. I thought that he was just no good. And he did what he did because he just was that way. So my brother suggested that we take a drink. And I said, well, you try it first. You see, my mother didn't raise any stupid children. And I wanted to see what would happen to him. So he upped the gallon jug that we had. And he dumped the drink down, and he said, it's nice. He said, it's really sweet. It's very fine.
And I took the same bottle, and I thought I was going to get the same thing that my brother got, wine. But I didn't. Because, you see, with my chemical body, what I got was relief from fear that I had known all my life. And in about 30 seconds, I looked at that bottle in amazement. I said, my goodness, what a wonderful thing that is. Because now, you see, I didn't care if my father was drunk. I didn't care if there was no money in the house. I didn't care about nothing. I just felt good for the first time in my life. I could sit down right now. I don't have to go any further. Because, you see, that is the difference between a normal person and an alcoholic. The alcoholic drinks because he gets relief from fear. He gets relief from a feeling of insecurity. He gets a relief from the feeling of being different, not able to do things that other people can do. And I looked at my brother and I said, what do you say, we have another one? He said, you're sure. So he had two. And when I took my second one, I was 10 foot tall. I could do anything. And I looked out at the world, and for the first time in my 12 years, I felt beautiful. I felt wonderful. And when I suggested to my brother, we have a third one, he said, no. And I want to tell you something that was over 40 years ago. And if you go out to Lynbrook, Long Island, you're an alcoholic, and you meet a fellow named Joe Brennan, don't drink with him. Because he'll give you the first one, and he'll give you the second one. And then the cork goes in the bottle, and the bottle goes back in the closet. You've had it. Because, you see, he's not an alcoholic. And he's all finished, and you just lit the fire. Well, that's what he did to me 40 years ago, and he's still doing it. He has never, ever needed more than two drinks. Brother John, different. Because, you see, I took my third drink and I told him if the Lord made anything better than this, he'd keep it up there for himself. And I believed it. Because anything that could make me feel that good, that was beautiful stuff. Next thing I remember was Sunday morning. And I didn't remember what happened Saturday night. I didn't remember anything after the third or fourth drink. And I had my mother bending over me crying, and she was crying bitterly. And for a person that loved my mother as I did, it was a horrible thing to see. And I sat up in the bed very quickly, and I was startled. And I said, what happened? And I had that terrible gnawing fear in my stomach. Remorse, that it's called. And we people in AA know what that is. Normal people don't know it. But we are sorry even when we haven't done anything. Even when we're innocent, we're sorry. I've noticed new people come into AA, they'd be standing with a nice new suit. Drinking a cup of coffee, and somebody will knock their arm and spill coffee all over them. They'll spill coffee, their coffee, over them, and they'll say, I'm sorry. And this is the alcoholic, and this is the remorse that we suffer from. And it's what drives us deeper into the bottle. Because we can't stand ourselves. We don't know what we did or how we did it. And this particular morning was my first experience with remorse. And I looked at my mother, I said, what happened? And she said, Jack, please, one in this family is enough. Don't ever do what you did again yesterday. And I said, what did I do? And she said, you drank almost 3/4 gallon of wine. And then you tried to take a bath and you passed out in the bathtub. And your father had to break the door from the hinges and pull you out of the tub, put you in bed, you slept all night. Please, Jack, no more. I can't take more. One is enough, promise me. And I promised her. I promised her with all the earnestness at my command, and I was a liar. Because anything that relieved me of the fear that I had, and it made me feel like everybody else in this world, I was not about to leave. But I thought, you know, that I could just sneak one here and there, and everything would be all right. I could live. Now I found a secret living. Well, you know, you say, how does a 12-year-old kid drink? Well, if you're an Irish Catholic, it's very easy. Just become an altar boy. And I have had some of the best drinks in my life in those sacristies. They really go first class. And I would get there early in the morning. I would ask for the 6 o'clock mass. And everything would be fine. Because, you know, there's nobody at the 6 o'clock mass. I'd get there 4:15. And everything would be fine. But there's only two little old ladies in the front row. They got shawls around their head and they're very quiet. They got to get there early because they're afraid they're not going to make the day, don't you see? And they stand there and the priest gets there a little later, but you're in the sacristy. You have your eye opener. And I did this many days. And I went to school. And not only did I go to school, I would tell the nun, come on out of the seat, sister, take a seat there. I'll take over the class today. You see, with a drink, I could do anything. With a drink, I could do anything. And I did anything. Well, it wasn't too long before, at 16 years of age, my mother threw me out of the house. Because, you see, I looked at my father working hard. And I had no shoes on my feet. And I wore my brother's shoes and my brother's pants, and I didn't like it. And I said, hard work is not for me, and I didn't believe in work. I still don't. I think work is for horses and fools. But I don't like to be in jail till I work. And I work pretty hard, too. It's a good thing I have my boss. He's afraid of me. And I can get away pretty good, you know, when I have to. And that's the way that it works. But you see, back then was different. Because I looked at money as my God. I had quit going to church because my prayers were never answered. My father was still drunk. And I came home this particular day, and my mother found me in the kitchen threatening my father with a gun. I had a roll of stolen money on the table. I had a bottle of whiskey, and I was daring him to touch either. I'd blow the top right over his head. My mother looked at me, and she said, I don't know where you came from. I don't understand how we ever had anyone like you. And your father may not be the best, but he's not like you. He's not vicious. You're nasty. She said, you have hurt everyone that you ever come in contact with from the moment that you were born. And she said, take your gun and your stinking money, your stinking stolen money, and get out of our lives and leave us alone. I left home. I left home and I was a madman. Because everything that I ever had was built into that woman, that mother that I had. I thought that she was a saint on earth and I loved her very dearly. And for her to throw me out of the house at 16, I just couldn't understand it. And I would say, why? That bum doesn't work and here I come home with money, she won't even take it. You see, alcohol had already started its progression on me. Because my progression was down. And I would say here now that alcoholism is a long, slow train ride. And it starts there and it goes to there. And if you persist in alcohol and drinking alcoholically, then you'll take the whole route and you'll go to the last stop. There is no reason for it now that Alcoholics Anonymous is here. But the alcoholic can go to any station that he wants and get off just any way he wants and still be an alcoholic. Because you see, I never thought that the things that happened to me in this world would ever happen to me. I thought that I was a pretty nice fellow. The only thing I did in the beginning was steal. And I stole little bits here, little bits there, and then I graduated, and then I started to run around with a mob in New York. And I was a real man for a mob for many years. And you see, I stole an awful lot of money in my time at the point of a gun, and I hurt a lot of people. I've been shot, and I've shot people. I've driven cars at 110 miles an hour up and down the coast of Jersey and Philadelphia, Massachusetts, you name it, I've done it. And I want to tell you something. I'm not a bit proud of what I've done. Because every time that I woke up, no matter where that it was, I would sit on the end of my bed and I would put my faith in my hands and I would be 12 years old and I'd be scared. I couldn't do the things that I did without alcohol. I couldn't. So you see how important it was for me to know when I came to AA that I was really sick physically, and that there was hope for me somewhere in this world. Because you see, of all the people that I've hurt, I still have to live with the memories that I have. And I tell you, there's a lot of them. And I've broken people across the bridge of their nose with a gun, and I can see the blood coming out of their eyes yet. Thank God for AA. Because it enables me to come into AA, it enabled me to come into AA, put the steps in my life, and to actually change my life and turn over completely. But by the time I got to AA, I had been down to the end of the road. And I'm pressed for time here today, and I just can't go into too much detail, but I must tell you what happened. Because you see, along the way, I even lost my job as a wheelman. My nickname was Crazy Jack the Umbriago. And any of you that ever see the Godfather was a lot of my friends. That's the way I lived. And you see, it was a big blow to me to lose my first job of alcoholism. Because, you see, I used to get up in the morning, I'd be 12 years old and scared, and I would smell my gun, count my money, and I would say, my God, what did I do now? And I had to reach out very quickly for another drink to bury me again. And the minute I took that drink to relieve me of the fear that I had and the feeling of being 12 years old and scared, then I was capable of doing the same thing again that night. And I was a never-ending rat race. And I would try to put the pieces together because I never remembered too good. Well, you know, when you're running with a bunch like I ran, and you come down to wherever you happen to be, a best hotel or a hideout in New York somewhere, and you start asking stupid questions like, how did it go last night? And they would look at me and they'd say, don't you know, you drove the car.
And little by little, it became apparent why they called me Umbriago. Because, you see, I didn't remember. And one day they called me in. They said, Jack, you're a good wheel man. You best in New York, Jersey, Connecticut, anywhere. You wonderful wheel man. But we think maybe you have a little problem. And maybe someday, you know, instead of taking us home, you might take us to a police station. Then what? So I lost my first job on account of alcoholism. And I went out on my own. And I operated up down the East Coast of New York, and I got arrested many, many times. I've been arrested over 125 times. And I've been charged with everything in the book except murder. And I'm going to tell you something. I shot a little here, and I shot a little there, too. And I'm not proud of this, but... You see what my problem was? That I always took me with me. If I could have left me home, I would have been all right. I would have, but I stuck up some places that were... Just you shouldn't stick up. That was it, period. And I used to go in and think it was daytime, and it was nighttime, and I think it was nighttime, it was daytime. And I had a hell of a time, and I never remembered what I did. And you know what a feeling it is, stand up before a judge and try and catch what the man is reading the charges, because you don't know. And when you wake up and you see the bars around, you don't know whether you're in a hospital or in a jail. Horrible feeling. I don't recommend it. And I would like you to remember, too, that each time this happened to me, I was back to being that 12-year-old scared kid. And I used to sit in my cellar, and I used to promise myself never again. I have to do something different. I can't go on like this. I was not born to be this way. But I went on. And I got married, and I had a very lovely wife. She was a very naive and simple girl. Never knew anything about what I did. And married her, and we had a baby. And I didn't work too good, you know. I didn't work at all, period. I stole. And she liked my friends very much. She thought they were very interesting people. I never told her, of course, what they did for a living, and she never bothered to ask me, and she used to run with me pretty good, and we had a ball, plenty of money, but then things changed because I began to realize that I was having trouble with alcohol, and I began to realize that there was something in me that made me like my father, and I didn't want to be like my father. I hated my father. In fact, I had threatened to shoot him on sight. My brothers and sisters had long since given up on me. They wouldn't talk to me. They wouldn't answer the door if I rang the bell. They were terrified of me. So I was a madman when I drank. And this is the situation. The only one I was ever gentle with was my wife. Because I depended on her for everything. And I would come home, and if I was hurt, she would bandage me up and try and get me a doctor. And if I was sick, she would nurse me a little bit. And she never said too much about my alcoholism because she never knew. I was never home that much. And when I was home, it was more like party night. Let's go out and get drunk. I've been away for a week. So you see, my wife was a very naive, simple individual. But little by little, she learned. I left home, and I went to sea. And I went to sea in order to get away from my wife. Not that I didn't love her very greatly. I did. Not that I didn't want to be the husband that she expected. But I couldn't let her see me getting up in the morning. I was ashamed. I knew there was something wrong with me. And I was getting more like my father every day, and I didn't like it. So I was going to give this thing a good fight, a good battle, and I did. I beat myself right into the ground trying to beat booze. You see, because I went to sea and the war started, I had a lot of trouble in the war, and I came home finally after the Normandy invasion. I came home in a hospital ship after being in a coma for 16 days. And I was in a coma for 16 days because I'd been beaten to a pulp. I went into a prison of war stockade, and I took on about 5,000 German prisoners of war. It's kind of a stupid thing to do now that I look back at it, but it seemed to be a good idea at the time. I did that because that particular day my booze deserted me for the first time. I drank myself sober. And any alcoholic that's sitting here will know the effect of drinking yourself sober. You pour it in like there's no tomorrow, and the more you drink, the more clear your head becomes. A very unusual phenomenon. But it happens. It happened to me, and I went completely berserk. Because booze wouldn't deaden me anymore. And I couldn't go down and do my job in the engine room of a ship. And I went into this prison of war stockade. I was beat up quite bad. I was in a hospital for 2 months, and then the doctor told me, no more war for you. Go home. You're the hero. I wanted to kill him. Because now if I went home, my cigarette would be out. So I argued and I fought, but I went home. And now this woman... This naive, simple woman, her education started. But I walked into a house where there was a baby and her, and I asked for booze.
And she said, what are you talking about? I said, whiskey, booze. And she said, Jack, I live here with a baby. I have no booze. And I said, well, go down and get some. So she went down and got some, and a couple of 3 hours later, she performed that feat again. And she began to look at her husband with different eyes, but I didn't care no more. Now it was a struggle for survival with me, and the only way that I could survive was to drink. So I drank around the clock. I drank morning, noon, and night because I couldn't leave it down. If I left it down, I would die. I was sure of that. But this went on for a little bit, and then she said to me, Jack, you're having trouble with alcohol. And I said, don't even talk about it. Because, you see, along the way, people have tried to help me with alcohol. And everybody that tried to help me, whether it be a priest or a social worker or a minister, whether it's a prison or a hospital, it didn't matter. They all tried to help me, but they all started with the same thing. Stop drinking, we can help you. I said, go to the devil, because I can't stop drinking. You're talking to somebody, help me with my drinking, but don't ask me to stop because I can't. I can stop breathing easier than I can stop drinking. I'm one of those peculiar people. I thought that I was all alone in this world. I'm one of those peculiar people that couldn't live without a drink, not for even 2 hours. Now, my wife was a very determined woman. She went out one day and she inquired here and there. I don't know where she went, but she found out about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came home with this big book. And she gave it to me. I looked at the title and I threw it through the window. And I told her that she would follow it if she ever mentioned it again. Because I am not an alcoholic. An alcoholic is that bum that my father is. I'm not an alcoholic. But she was determined. And she was learning fast. And one day I got up and I went down to my favorite bar. And I ordered a drink, and the guy said, no, good, get out, quick. I said, what's the matter? And he said, your wife was here. And she said, if I give you even one drink today, she's going to burn my bar down. And I said, she must have been, something's wrong. I went to a delicate death, and a little man in there threw me out. I couldn't get a drink nowhere in a radius of 10 miles. So I went back home loaded for bear, and I said, what did you do? She said, I picked you, didn't I? I said, yeah, you picked me, all right, but I'm going to pick you. She said, now wait just a minute. You want a drink? I said, yeah, I want a drink. I got to have a drink. And she said, well, you get on the subway with me. You know what it is to get on the subway when you're an alcoholic? Man, you got to ride through a long tunnel, and you wait for that damn thing to stop halfway, and you die 1,000 deaths. So I got on the subway for a drink. And we went to New York, and she bought me another one and shook me up so bad. And she said, now we're going into that Protestant church. I said, Protestant church? What, are you out of your mind? I'm an Irish Catholic. Of course, I hadn't been to church in 20 years. I was wanted in 4 states, but I was an Irish Catholic. In fact, when I stuck you up, if you weren't an Irish Catholic, you didn't even get carfare. Nothing. You didn't belong in this world. You're only here for me to abuse. If you open your mouth too big, I'd break your head for you. But I went into that church because she said, if you don't get another drink. And I went in and I said, what is this stuff? And she said, this is an AA meeting. I said, what is that? She said, they're going to help you. I said, oh, they're going to help me like everybody else helped me. And I said, all right, I'll sit in the back and I'll listen, but they better help me quick. Because I can't stand too much of this. And some jackass got up here like I'm up here today. And do you know what he said? Don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk. And I said, he's out of his mind. How can you get drunk if you don't drink? I'm not an idiot. I understand that. What do I have to come from Brooklyn to New York to hear that for? And I threatened him from the back of the room, and I got out just before the cops arrived. So that when I get out, if you ever pull that on me again, I'll bury you. And she said, you're helpless. You're hopeless. I'm trying to help you. You won't even listen. I said, get away from me. Don't bother me. Leave me alone, because now the lines were drawn, don't you see? Now I was a battle for survival. They were going to take my booze away from me, like hell they were. There was nobody in this world big enough to do that. Nobody. I would drink if
God stood in front of me and told me not to. I had to. So I drank. I came home one night, 3 or 4 days, a week, and there were 2 cops sitting in my apartment. If there's any cops here today, forget it. We're all friends today. I will admit there was a time that I didn't like you too well. But that has long since passed. I'm an honorary policeman in 5 states. I can't even get locked up anymore. But then it was different. I was full of hate, and I saw these 2 cops in my apartment. I said, what are you doing here? Get the hell out. And they said, no, we're here because your wife called us. She needs protection from you. And I said, not for me. I don't do anything to hurt my wife or my family. And he said, take a look at her throat, buddy. I looked at her throat, it was marked. I said, that was not me. I wasn't even here. He said, yes, you were. You're a maniac. You had her hanging out a 6-story window last night. And I said, no, not me. I denied it because, you see, now I was sober. And sober, I wouldn't hurt you. But the mental manifestation of the disease after one drink, I'm capable of anything. Capable of anything. So I invited these 2 gendarmes to leave, and they refused. So I threw them. They frowned on that in Brooklyn, too. I threw them down the stairs, and they went out and they get reinforcements, and then they threw me down the stairs. And then they liked it pretty good, so they took me back up and did it again. And then they took me down into the back alley, and they beat me to a bloody pulp. Then he put me and put me into a straitjacket and put me into Kings County Hospital. Because, you see, they couldn't keep me on the floor. And they had to do what they did. And I have no animosity toward them because it was either me or them. But I will tell you something. And when you wake up in a hospital in a straitjacket, it's not nice. Because the first thing that you know is that you don't belong there. And you look about you and you say, my God, what am I doing? And then you look about and you can taste the blood in your mouth. And you can feel the stitches in your head and you can feel your ribs caved in. And you have your arms strapped tightly across your chest and you're strapped to a bed. And you can't go to the bathroom, you can't get a drink of water, you can't do anything. And you pray just that you won't die. Because your heart is pounding out of that straitjacket right out of your mouth. And you're so full of fear that it's pitiful. And you promise God and your mother and your father that that's the last time. But you go home at the respectable time. And you sit in a corner because now you're 12 years old again and you're scared. And you can't operate without alcohol, so you sit in your corner and you vegetate. And your brother comes and says, come on, I'll buy you a job downtown. You're all right now. And you can't explain to him how you can't get out the house. You can't walk across the street. There's nothing you can do. You just sit. And your sister comes and she says, my husband is working 2 jobs to support your family. Why don't you go out and get a job? And again, you have to sit like Dinny the Dunce and you can't explain to nobody. You can't move. And if the phone rings, you go through the ceiling. And if the kids cry or holler, you get upset because you can't stand it, your nerves. And all the time you say, what's wrong with me? And how can I live this way? And you can't, you know it. But the end comes and you say, please give me a dollar. Give me a dollar, for God's sake, give me a dollar. I have to get one drink. And if I get just one drink, I'll be able to get a job. I'll get on the phone. I'll do something, but I can't sit here no more. I'm going out of my mind. So your wife gives you a dollar. And you go down the corner. You take one drink, just one. You don't want no trouble. You had enough trouble. But you take one drink, it's like somebody turned the key up in your head. And all your good intentions go out the window, and then you start looking for the cop that beat on you last week. And you find them, because they all got the same face. Don't make no difference. And you bash him. And he takes you in the alley, he bashes you, and he gets tired, he gets some help. And again, please, stay down. Don't get up no more, because we'll have to kill you after we'll kill me. Because I'm going to get you. And again, you wind up in the same straitjacket in the same hospital. And you're getting asked the same stupid questions. You're giving the same stupid answers. And you repeat your thing over and over and over. You tell you an AA, it's a rat race, you best believe it. Because that was the thing I lived in, a rat race. I didn't want what I was getting, but I was getting it. And I'd wake up at the hospital, I'd be so quiet. I'd be so gentle because I knew I didn't belong there. I was 12 years old and scared. Then they sent me home again. I repeated this 12 different times. 12 times. I'm blind in one eye, and I go here out of one ear. My equilibrium is bad, and you're affected. And if you put your hand on top of my head, you could feel stitches like it was a piece of cardboard. And I've had almost every bone in my body broken. I've had my teeth kicked up into the roof of my mouth. I have my jaws broken through the time. I have my nose broken so open. The last time I went to the doctor, he said, "Looks pretty good. Let's leave it that way." I have 203 stitches in that part of my right hand. I put it through a windshield of an automobile night. They told me my mother had died. Shatterproof glass, it shattered. And I almost killed 6 months that were trying to help me by stitching up my hand. I took cans of ether around the operating room. I almost passed everybody out. And when I woke up, I was in a straitjacket again. And I didn't know why he was even there. There was a cop at the foot of my bed. He looked at me, son, and he said, "If you move just one eyeball, he said, I'm going to beat you with unconsciousness again because you're a madman." And I sat with a big bubble on my plastic bubble, and I looked at the mess that my hand was, and they told me I'd never use my hand again. And when they told me 203 stitches, I didn't see how it was possible to put them all in such a small area. And I got thrown out of that hospital 2 days later for getting drunk in bed. I went away from that hospital with 203 stitches, and in the back of a bar down in Greenwich Village in New York, a week or 10 days later, I took them out myself. Never went back to the hospital. Maniac. But you see, now my time was drawing to a close because when I came out of hospital for the 12th time, there were two detectives waiting for me. And they took me down and they said I couldn't get a drink that particular day, that the judge wanted to see me sober. And I went to a court where a judge was sitting waiting for me. And my wife was there and my children were there too by this time. And I was scared and I was 12 and I had ice water in my belly, but I was a hard guy, wasn't I? You see, we alcoholics are two people, and we bury the one that we don't like, and we put on this hard front. So I stood in front of a judge that knew me by my first name. I'd been there so many times. And he said to me, "Jack, don't be frightened." He said, "I don't know how you feel." He said, "But I got to bring you in." He said, "I want to explain something to you." He said, "Please try and understand." And I said, "I'll understand anything that you got to say." I said, "I'm not stupid." He said, "No, you're not stupid, but you're a very sick boy." And he had a prognosis of me by three doctors in New York. Very fine doctors, believe it. They knew what they were talking about. And they said that Jack Brennan is a homicidal maniac. And that he might wipe his family out overnight, not even know that he did it. And they said, "Jack Brennan, it's impossible for him to know the difference between right and wrong." And they said that this man will not live for the next 5 years. And if he does live for 5 years, he'll be in a mental institution because he's suffering from very badly damaged brain induced to the use and abuse of alcohol. He'll never ever be able to work another day in his life. And it was signed by these three doctors, and I denied it all. See, because now I was sober, and I was scared, but I wouldn't hurt you. But you see, my story proves that when I drank, I would kill you. And the doctors knew this, and they were right. And I didn't know what year it was. I didn't know who was the mayor. I didn't even know who was the president. And I used to blame it all on booze. I didn't know my telephone or my home address. And the alcohol had taken its toll on me. And I turned to my wife and I said, "What are you going to do?" And she said, "Ask the man, he'll tell you." Now my wife was no more long a naive, simple girl. Because you see, the judge told me, he said, "Your wife has requested that you be removed from the home for the protection of her family." And I looked at her and I said, "Is that what you want?" She said, "You bet your life. You bet your life." She said, "Jack, I have two kids. And I'm going to give them a chance to live." And she used almost the same identical words that my mother used. And she said, "You've done nothing but hurt everybody you come in contact with. And we're going to take no more from you." And she said, "I will tell you something. The kids have been awarded to me." And she said, "They're mine now. I'm going to raise them. They're going to be right. And if you stick your filthy face in my home again where I'm raising my children, I'm going to kill you like somebody should have killed you a long time ago." She said, "I'll get you in the nighttime when you're sleeping. And I'll stick a knife in your belly, and if God is above me, I'll kill you. Because I hate your guts." And then again she said, "Get out of our lives and leave us live." And I said, "I'll get." And I told her that day, I remember, I said, "You'll need me before I need you." She said, "No. And don't you believe it." So I was taken out of court, and I was put on a subway to New York for free over the turnstile by two detectives. And they told me, "Don't come back to Brooklyn. Well, I never heard anybody before that was ever thrown out of Brooklyn. But I was, and I went to New York full of hate, and I was going to get a gun, and I was going to do a lot of things, but that was all alcoholic dreams. You see, alcoholic living in another world. And I was going to do this, I was going to do that, but I wasn't even able to get out of my own way, because our doctors were right. So I went to New York, and I lived on the Bowery for 2.5 years. Now, you're looking at a Bowery derelict. And I want to tell you something, I was just as filthy and dirty as any Bowery derelict ever was, and I had body life, and I had hair down the back of my neck, and I got hit with cabs, and I fell down cellar stairs, and I was full of blood and puke and vermin, and I didn't even feel a thing. There was only one thing I was obsessed with, and that was hate. And every time that I woke up, I would see myself or smell myself before I could see myself, and it used to come back to me a tremendous ball of hate. And you see, I would hate God, and I would curse God every time that I opened my eyes. For allowing me, the kid that used to sit next to my mother to protect her from a maniac of a husband, alcoholic, and you let this happen to me, and my wife, after as good as I was to her, what she did to me, and threw me out of my home. Everybody was wrong except me. And my brothers, they wouldn't help me. And my sisters, they could die too. I hated everybody. And I would take a morning drink, and I would walk a few steps and fall down again. And I slept in the snow, in the rain, in the cold. It didn't bother me one bit because I was obsessed with hate. I had scars all over my head where I fell down, and I didn't even bother to go to a hospital or anything. It just dried up and went away. That was it. I was dying. I was on my last legs. My train had come to the end of the station. And even then, I was willing to die for something that I believed. I didn't believe that I could live without alcohol. You see, one day I went into a bar to take my morning drink into a filthy bathroom in a Bowery bar. And I took a drink of wine that I had in a bottle. It was 15 cents for a pint. And I had about a half a bottle. And I slept with it like it was a baby. And I guarded it all night because I needed it the next morning. And I took my morning drink and I threw it up. And I threw half my stomach with it. And I had hemorrhages in the stomach. And I was so weak, I fell down and hooked my chin on a toilet bowl. And I said, my God, what now? And I watched myself literally running down a toilet bowl. And I looked at the bottle in my hand, and I said, it's got to be this. Because I couldn't blame nothing else no more. And I threw it over my shoulder, and I said, I don't want to live no more. Why do I fight? So I resigned myself to die, don't you see? But my friend upstairs, he's a very funny fellow. And he watches, we alcoholics, good, you had best believe it. He watches us well. And there's so many that are called and so few that are chosen. I feel so very close to my friend upstairs. Because I think I see through AA how that he operates. You see, when a cry, as Bill Wilson did, uttered a cry in despair for help, it gets immediate attention. Because a person, a human being, who is in the depths of despair is denying the existence of God, and that can't happen. Well, the man upstairs gets very busy when a cry of despair is uttered. But he said, I lay there and my cry of despair came too. Because I didn't die immediately, and I remember the haze that I was in and the fog that I was in. But pictures of that AA meeting came back to me. While I was laying there, I know there had to be, with my mental condition and my sick body, it had to be only one person that could do that. It had to be the higher power. And suddenly I was above that meeting that I had been at so many years before. And I saw all those people walking about, drinking coffee, and smiling, all clean. And I said to me, oh, Jack, you had it, you blew it, you muffed it. You had the answer, you blew it. You're a damn fool. And I remember with my mind how clear that it was. And I remember how I wanted so much to be a part of that picture. And I said, my God, why didn't I listen? Why didn't I listen? And you know something? I said, if only it weren't too late. And that was my cry of despair. My friend upstairs very late. And he heard my cry. And I crawled out of that bedroom some 7 or 8 hours later on my hands and knees. And I begged somebody to call AA for me, and they did. I don't know who it was to this minute, but I remember somebody saying in my ear, sit down and don't wander away, because I did call them and they're coming. And I had to sit there and forcibly keep myself seated. Because, see, the alcoholic, he sits here, but his mind is there, and he don't know where his body's going. He's involved with what he's thinking. And I had to be very careful that I was not following the will of the wisp that the alcoholic does in the condition I was in. And I had to keep there, they're coming. Then I had to reassure myself that, yeah, I did hear it. It wasn't some noise. It wasn't some dream. They're coming. And I tried to wipe some of the blood off myself, and I tried to look like a human being. How could you? Hair down here, no shoes, no socks, no underwear, a pair of filthy pants and a filthy shirt. That's all that I own in this world. And they came. Now, I was bragged about being an Irish Catholic. And I thought the guy coming would be at least named Murphy or Callahan or something. And my sponsor came through the door with his wife, and the first thing he said to me was, "My God." And the second thing he said, "Well, that's all right." He said, "My name is Sam Cohen, and I'm here to help you." You new people, when they read that preamble, listen good. No religion in AA. Because this little beautiful man, Sam Cohn, and his wife, Jeannie, they stood there and they looked at me, and I looked at them. Jeannie was not an alcoholic, but Sam was, and all she could do was hold a hand over her mouth. She was so terrified. She had never seen anything like me. And Sam told her, he said, "It's all right, Jeannie. He's an alcoholic." And he said, "Do you want to come with us?" And he told me something that I longed so much to hear. He said, "If you come with us, Jack," he said, "you don't have to drink no more and you're going to be all right." Now, either this man was an idiot, he was the biggest fool that walked on the face of the earth, because he flew directly in the face of three very scientific and very right doctors. Or he was either a fool or he had a secret. I know he had a secret. Because, you see, he had been in AA, and he had been down where I had been. Not quite as far, but he had had his bottom. And he knew the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knew where it came from. And he said, "Without fear of contradiction, you come with me, and you don't have to drink no more, and you'll be all right." So I came with him. And he was right. Because that was 25 years ago. And I had 25 years of living. I have had 25 years of a second life. Do you wonder why I'm so grateful? Do you wonder why I get stuck in old damn plane to come here to tell you about it? I must. Because what Sam Cohn for me did for me, I must do for you, someone sitting out there today. Because I have to earn my life. I just can't sit back and say, "Well, now I got it, you get it." I can't do that. Because my gratitude would strangle me if I did it. Just like my hate used to strangle me, now my gratitude would do the same. So I went with Sam. Excuse me. And I went with his little wife, Jean. And I went to AA, and from the first moment that I arrived, I found what I was looking for in the bottom of a bottle for so many years. Understanding. Nobody ever said to me, "Get that bum out of here, he stinks too bad." Nobody ever said anything unkind to me. Everybody said, "Welcome." They said, "Come in. This is the place for you." And they would give me a cup of coffee. I'd sit in the back of the room, and they would turn their back because I couldn't pick up a cup of coffee. And I had to bend over and lap it up like a dog, and nobody wanted to watch me and embarrass me. Oh, I got understanding. I got understanding beyond human understanding, believe it. I had friends that they just looked at me and they said, "Jack, for God's sake, please keep coming. We need you." And I couldn't understand them. You see, all my life I had been told to be like somebody else. And these people said, "No. And don't be like somebody else. Just be you. And then we can help you. Because if we know you, we have the answer here for any problem that you have." So for the first time in my life, I could be myself. And when I heard, I heard, I told everybody I heard. And when I didn't understand what was said, I don't understand. And they were very patient and kind, and they told me over and over again the same thing. And then one day they said to me, "Jack, we love you." Then I said, "Why would you love me? I don't understand." And they said, "Well, Jack, we love you because you're an alcoholic." Now I ask you, in all sincerity, has anybody before AA ever loved you because you were an alcoholic? No. No. The most loving wife will tolerate you, and your parents will love you in spite of your being an alcoholic, but nobody ever loved me before I came to AA because I was an alcoholic. So I learned to live, and I was taught by a little Jewish man so much that I love him, because just before he died, I loved him like my father. He could do no wrong. He knew, and I didn't. You see, because I had a little room, and they let me wash dishes, and one day they told me that I was growing spiritually. They said, "How do you figure that?" Well, you will understand what I told you, what spirituality is, those that are wanted, needed, and loved. Well, I was wanted, and I was loved, and one day they told me that I was needed. And I said, "How do you figure that?" And he said, "Well, Jack, you're very useful. You see, every time that we get a new individual into the group, we sit him next to you and we tell him to watch you. And that if he keeps drinking, he's going to get like you." So now, sick as I was, my spiritual growth had started, and I was so happy. They even let me wash dishes. And 2 weeks after they let me wash dishes, they went to paper cups because I broke so many. But they never hollered at me. And I lived beautifully. I got a little job. And everything worked out well for me. And I was just as happy as I could be. I had my group, and I couldn't hear much, and I couldn't see much. And I couldn't understand much, but I could feel inside the love that people had for me. So I kept coming. And if I didn't get another nickel or another dime anywhere in this world, I was happy with what I had. But you see, my friend upstairs has different ideas. And I was sober for about 2 years or three. And one day my wife came to a meeting. And I told her, I said, "Hey, if you louse this up for me, I'm going to have a lot of trouble with you. This is the only thing that I got. Don't louse it up." I told Sam Cohn, I said, "Keep an eye on her. She's up to something." And you know, he told me, he says, "Boy, are you stupid. Boy, are you stupid." I said, "Yeah, I may be, but I'm not that stupid." And you know, she told me that night, she said, "Jack, I don't hate you. I'm so happy that you're sober. You see, I just have one thing to ask you." She said, "You paying money for a room?" And she said, "I have a couch in the living room. Would you like to come home and sleep on a couch in the living room? And then you could pay me what you're paying for a room, and I could use it for the kids. They're growing up." So I said, "Sure, I'd do that." So I went home and I slept on a couch in the living room. And I was in heaven. I could watch my kids going to school in the morning. I could watch them when they came home. And if there's anything left in the box when I come home from my meeting, I could eat a little bit. I didn't sit with them. I didn't eat with them. But I was home, and I was just so happy. And then, you know, one night she said to me, "Jack, isn't that couch getting a little hard?" And I said, "No." I said, "That's a nice couch." You see, I didn't even know that she was making improper advances. But she became a little more direct. And I got terrified. And I went up to the Holy Mountains in Graymore, and I spoke to a monk up there. It took me 3 days. And I said to the monk, I said, "Hey, my old lady's making a noise like a wife again." He said, "That's nice. That's good. Go home." How the hell did he know? He was a monk. So I went home. And I'm ashamed, really. I'm not ashamed, but I am ashamed, too. I had a terrible time. I had a terrible time. It was so hard, could you believe it, for a man, a full-grown man, to take his rightful place in a home. My little daughter had to teach me how to eat with a knife and a fork. She had to hold my hand while I learned to cut meat with my hand. And my son used to bring me my pipe and my tobacco and my cigarettes because I would forget them all the time. And I didn't remember where I had put them hardly ever. And he would take me to the door and he would say goodbye to me and make sure I knew where I was going. And my wife, she'd take me down the basement when the kids were in bed and sit me before a big mirror and teach me how to speak. Because my jaws were busted up so bad that I could speak without spitting all over everybody and nobody could hardly understand me. These are the things that I'm grateful for. These are the things that my friend upstairs gave me for free I didn't work for. I was satisfied to live a few years and die sober. I would have been very happy. But you see, it's because the alcoholic asks for so little that he gets so much, because God, the higher power, is so much more magnificent to us than we would be to ourselves. And if we only leave it to him, he's so much more generous than we would ever think of being. He gives us what we don't even ask for. So don't ask for nothing, as they tell you in AA. Turn your life and will over to the care of God as you understand him, and leave the rest to him, a very generous and beautiful man. I went to Sam Cohn one day, and I said, Sam, I have so much. I owe you my life. He said, you owe me nothing. You're stupid Irish. And I said, ooh, it's a good thing you're so small, because I would stomp you to the ground. And he said, Jack, when are you going to learn? What I did for you was done for me. And the guy that did it for me had it done for him. And if you take it all the way back, you go to Bill Wilson, and he had the higher power do it for him. So he said, you owe nothing to me or anyone else in AA. You owe it to the man upstairs. So if you want to say thanks to anyone, you thank him. I said, Sam, that's a dirty pool. I said, I haven't speak to him. I've cursed him every day before AA. I said, yeah, I'm not on speaking time. He said, that's your bag. And you straighten that out. Not me. He loves you very much, Jack, because he sent me out to get you. And he said, now that you're here, what are you going to do? He said, you have to make your peace with the man upstairs, because you owe him everything that you've got. And he said, you're truly grateful. You'll do it. And as I tell me how that I do it, he said, you talk to him like you talk to me. And then he said, no, wait a minute, you better clean it up a little bit first. So that night I walked home instead of riding the bus. And I spoke to my friend upstairs all the way home. And I told him, hey, friend, I haven't been doing too good up till this point. But I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you tell me what to do from here on in, I'm going to do it. Because I think you are the best thing that ever happened in my life. And I'm so grateful and I love you so good. I'm going to do the best that I can do in this world. You just tell me and point me in the right direction. That's what you've been doing for 25 years. And you know, some days I say to him, well, all right, I'm going to do it, but I don't think you're right. And I said, if you're wrong, don't come crying to me about it. But I'm going to do it. And you know something? He's always right. Never wrong. Well, I'm going to get finished here pretty sudden. I don't like to talk when I'm not supposed to be. There are just a few more things that I have to say. You see, my wife, beautiful woman, and I picked a guy up one night out of the gutter, but my wife was of a different religion than I was. My children weren't baptized. And I had no ever thought of ever being able to change his picture. I had accepted the things I couldn't change. I picked a guy up out of gutter one night and I took him home because he had no place to stay. And I threw him in half and told the wife, I said, to keep an eye on him, he said, I won't hurt you. Give him plenty of coffee. I'll be back. I got to go to work. So she watched him and gave him coffee. And he sobered up. And he turned out to be very religious and very well studied in Catholicism. While I was out working and she was feeding him coffee, he was teaching her about religion. And one day I came home, my wife said to me, I'm going to be converted and I'm going to join your church. But it was a miracle again, all by itself. Every night, thing that I did. So she went up to church and she was converted. We were married on the altar, Royal PH in Brooklyn. My two children backed us up, and right after the wedding, they were baptized. My biggest problem had been removed. Now I could go back to church, my wife with me, my children too. And then one day I said to the man upstairs, I said, you know, it's a shame I never raised a kid, and I love kids. And 2 weeks later, she said, I'm pregnant. I said, man, you work quick. So now I have 3 children. Not 2. Now my youngest boy is a National Merit Scholarship winner. And he goes to Haverford College in Pennsylvania. And he came out in the top 0.5% of this country. And a very beautiful, gentle boy. I thank God for him. My daughter has made me a grandfather. She married a lawyer. I told her she didn't have to marry a lawyer, but she did. I don't even get a ticket anymore. What the hell I need a lawyer for? And she married this jackass, and what am I going to tell you? And my oldest son, you see, he was 18. He graduated from school with honors, and he won the French medal. Very lovely boy, 6'3", black curly hair. But he's an alcoholic. My father, an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. My son, an alcoholic. Doctors tell us that the disease will appear 4 times to 1 more readily in a family where there's a history than when there isn't. So there's nothing unusual about my son being an alcoholic. The thing that's unusual about my son being an alcoholic is that he had gone the same route that I went. And then he started at 18 when he graduated from school and joined the Marine Corps. And it's been my own happy privilege to see him, visit him in a state prison doing a year flat. He stuck up joints. Done a lot of nasty, horrible things, but he's my son. What should I do, to make excuses for him? No. The only thing I can say is that he's an alcoholic. And then when he drinks, he can do things that he's not normally capable of doing. But you see, for 10 years, I've watched my son go down the drain. And I had to take my wife, because she again reiterated what my mother had said. She said to me about 4 or 5, 6 years ago, Jack, why does your friend upstairs inflict 2 on me? 1 is enough. And that I don't know. I don't know, Roz. I don't understand why, but why don't you ask him? So she did ask him. And the answer came back loud and clear. I can't tell you when. But if the boy wants AA, it's there. Don't worry about it. Leave it in my hands. So I left it in his hands, and my wife did too. And we raised our other 2 children best we could, and always prayed for the boy. And you know, at Christmas time, this past Christmas, my son called me from Rochester, New York. And he said, Pop, I want to come home for Christmas. He said, I want to bring my wife. I didn't even know he had one. I want to bring my baby. I didn't even know he had that. And I said, Joe, you're not welcome in this house unless you're sober and intend to go to AA. It's the only way that we can tolerate you. We have to live too, and we can't live with you. He said, Pop, I want to go to AA. I've had it. I'm sick and tired of being tired. I said, stay to the post office or go to the telegraph office. I'll send you the money. So I sent him the money. And he came home. My son came home, and he'd come home from college, and everything was fine. And we had a beautiful Christmas. My God, it was the best Christmas we ever had. All the packages were wrapped on time. No last-minute shopping. Everybody was happy. Nobody hollering at each other. Kids didn't fall down the stairs. My wife was delirious. And when they all went home, you know, she said, Jack, your friend upstairs is so right, so good. Yeah, I love him more every day, just like you do. I said, I told you, I have only the nicest friends. Well, you see, I was going to Midland, Texas. My son was in AA. I was going to Midland, Texas. My wife was happy. And on 20th of January, I got tremendously upset. I was due to leave on a Friday. I was going to stay Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I got terribly upset, and I couldn't understand why. I know now it was my friend upstairs gnawing at me. He was alerting me, and I didn't know it. And I came home, I said, I don't feel too good. She said, well, the moon isn't up there. I don't know what's wrong with you. So I said, well, I don't know either, but... She said, well, when you have a good sleep tonight, they'll be back tomorrow. So I got the next day, I was worse. That was Thursday. So I went to the airport, and I didn't go to work. I went to the airport, and I had a big argument about my tickets changing them so late, you know, from Friday to Saturday morning. And when I come home, I told her that, and she said, Jack, you shouldn't have done it, because now you only got an hour between getting off the plane and the banquet. Like, I don't care. I just got to stay home. I don't know why. I just feel bad. And that night, you know, Friday night, instead of being in Midland, I was home. And I went into my bed about 11 o'clock. My bag was packed, shit packed, and she was teasing me. She said, "My, you look so sad. Why don't you cheer up?" I said, "Rod, I can't. I don't know what's wrong with me." I said, "But you go to bed, hon, and everything will be all right. I'll get to Texas tomorrow, and everything will be fine. I'll be back Sunday night." Well, that night, it's about 1:30, she woke me up. She said, "Jack, I can't breathe." And, you know, I every night I put my head on a pillow, I hear the same thing. "Jack, I can't breathe." And I got out of bed in a stupor, you know, and I looked for her behind the door where she was sitting, and I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I just can't breathe. I don't know." And I helped her breathe, and I took her downstairs, called an ambulance, put in the ambulance, and I followed the ambulance to the hospital. And she died this morning at 5 o'clock, January 22, 1972. And a lot of people will say to me, "Well, why are you so happy?" Well, I'm not happy because my wife is dead. I'm not happy because I'm alone, because I tell you something, they buried hair for me when they buried her. And she taught me everything that I know. I would never have been able to help anybody in this world had she not told me. And she taught me so many things. We live together so good. But I tell you, I am the happiest man in this world. And I went outside that hospital that morning at 5 o'clock, and it was bitter cold, and I had forgotten my coat. And I said to my friend upstairs, I said, "I don't know why." I said, "But you've been awful, awful good to me. You gave her back to me for 25 whole years. I can't fault you now." And I said, "You must need her up there awful bad if you need her more than I do." And I said, "I accept the things I can't change. And I do have the courage to change the things that I can. And AA has taught me to have the wisdom to know the difference between the two. So I'm here tonight, and I'm going to tell you again, loud and clear, I love AA because it's a tremendous manifestation of my friend upstairs. It's his way of working among we human beings to do his will. And they tell us every time that we read these traditions and steps, the steps are the things that strong men climb towards spiritual perfection and never achieve it, but the fight and the struggle is what makes it worthwhile. So I can move a mountain with a spoon, and I have enough faith for everybody sitting in this room and any other room. And I'll say the same thing to you today, what Sam Cohen told me years ago. "Jack, you come into AA, and you don't have to drink no more, and you'll be all right." That's a guarantee from a higher power that loves you very greatly. Very greatly. So if you're sitting out there, and you're this way and that way, and jump in with 2 feet, and I will say this to you, that if I can do it, you can do it too. The morning that I got on a plane to come down here, my oldest son picked up a drink. And he beat the hell out of his wife and busted up his house and wrecked his car. And I had to come down here and leave him drunk and sick in a house. And I don't know what I'm going to find when I get back. But that doesn't take away or detract that this program is here and it will work if you want it. And if you don't want it, there's nobody in this God's will that can make you take it. So we don't tell you to take it. We beg you, please, come into AA and give it a fighting chance. And you'll be like me, and you'll be like all the other miracles that you see here anywhere in AA. This morning I got up and I opened my eyes and I said my little prayer. It's called Secret. I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best. And his presence comes like sunrise, like a glory in my breast. All day long that presence lingers, and all day long he stays with me. And we sailed in perfect calmness o'er every troubled sea. So I think I know the secret learned from many a troubled way. You must seek him in the morning if you want him throughout the day. I won't put my feet out of the bed until I had that little prayer. Because 25 years later, I'm still an alcoholic. I suffer from the same physical disease, and I take one drink, I'm dead. So I have to necessarily in the morning know who I am and where I'm going. And I don't know this until I take one look at my friend upstairs and say, "Thank you for this morning. I'm going to do the best I can today." That much more I can tell you. I would just thank everybody for being so kind to me while I've been here. And I would like to leave you with a little blessing that I love so well. May the rose rise with you, and may the wind always be at your back. And may the sun gently warm your face, and may the rain softly fall on your fields. And until we meet again, may the good Lord hold us all in the holiday of the season. Thank you, and God.